He wore a gray Sardaukar-style uniform with epaulets and silver and gold trim. But the military trappings no longer comforted him as they once had. In addition to the birth of yet another daughter, he had much on his mind. Recently, at a gala concert in one of the inverted pyramid stadiums on Harmanthep, someone had released a giant inflated effigy of Shaddam IV. Obscenely insulting, the gaudy caricature made him look like a buffoon. The inflatable construction had drifted over the vast, laughing crowds until the Harmanthep Dragoon guards had shot it down in flaming tatters. And any fool could see the symbolism in that act. Despite the most rigorous crackdown and interrogation, even Sardaukar investigators were not able to determine who'd been responsible for creating or releasing the effigy. In another incident, 100-meter-high letters had been scrawled across the granite wall of Monument Canyon on Canadar 2. Shaddam, does your crown rest comfortably on your pointy head? In scattered worlds across the Imperium, dozens of his new commemorative statues had been defaced. Nobody had ever seen the perpetrators. Someone hated him enough to do this. Someone. The question kept gnawing at his imperial heart, along with other worries, including an impending visit from Hasimir Fenring to report on the secret synthetic spice experiments being conducted by the Tleilaxu. Project Amal. Initiated during his father's reign, this research was known to only a few. Perhaps the most closely guarded secret in the Imperium, Project Amal could, if successful, give House Corino a reliable, artificial source of melange, the most precious substance in the universe. But the damned Tleilaxu experiments were taking years too long, and the situation upset him more and more with each passing month. And now, a third cursed daughter. He didn't know when, or if, he would bother to gaze upon this useless new girl child. Shaddam's gaze moved along the paneled wall to a bookcase that contained a stand-up hollow photo of Anirul in her wedding gown, shelved next to a thick reference volume of great historical disasters. She had large doe eyes, hazel in some light, darker at other times, that concealed something. He should have noticed before. It was the third time this Bene Gesserit of hidden rank had failed to produce the required male heir, and Shaddam had made no contingency plans for such an eventuality. His face grew hot. He could always impregnate a few concubines and hope for a son, but while legally married to Anirul, he would face tremendous political difficulties if he attempted to declare a bastard his heir for the imperial throne. He could also kill Anirul and take another wife. His father had done that enough times. But such a course of action would risk the wrath of the Bene Gesserit sisterhood. Everything could be solved if Anirul would just give him a son, a healthy male child he could call his heir. All these months of waiting, and now this. He'd heard that the witches could actually choose the gender of their children through manipulations in body chemistry. These daughters could be no accident. He'd been deceived by the Bene Gesserit power brokers who had foisted Anirul on him. How dare they do that to the emperor of a million worlds? What was Anirul's true purpose in his royal household? Was she gathering blackmail information to use against him? Should he send her away? He tapped a stylus on his blood-grained Ilaka wood desk, stared at an image of his paternal grandfather, Fondil III. Commonly known as the Hunter for his propensity to attack every vestige of rebellion, Fondil had been no less feared in his own household. Though the old man had died long before Shaddam's birth, he knew something of the hunter's moods and methods. Had Fondio been faced with an arrogant wife, he would have found a way to rid himself of her. Shaddam pressed a button on his desk, and his personal chamberlain re-entered the study. Redondo bowed, showing the gleaming top of his high forehead. Sire? I wish to see Anirul now. Here. The lady is in bed, sire. Don't make me repeat my order. Without another word, Redondo faded into the woodwork, disappearing through the side door with long, spidery movements. Moments later, a pale and overly perfumed lady-in-waiting arrived. In a shaky voice, she said, My Emperor, the Lady Anirul wishes me to convey that she is weakened from the birth of your child. She begs your indulgence in permitting her to remain in bed. Might it be possible for you to consider coming to visit her and the baby? I see. She begs my indulgence? I am not interested in seeing another useless daughter, or in hearing further excuses. This is a command from your emperor. Anirul is to come here now. She is to do it alone, without the aid of any servant or mechanical device. Is that understood? With any luck, she would drop dead along the way. Terrified, the lady-in-waiting bowed. As you wish, sire. Presently, a gray-skinned Anirul stood in the doorway of his private study, holding tight to the fluted support column. She wore a wrinkled scarlet and gold robe that did not entirely conceal the nightclothes underneath. Though swaying on her feet, she held her head high. What do you have to say for yourself? He demanded.
I've just had a difficult childbirth, and I'm quite weak.
Excuses, excuses. You are intelligent enough to figure out what I mean. You've been clever enough to fool me all these years.
Fool you?
She blinked her doe eyes at him as if he were out of his mind.
Forgive me, Majesty, but I am tired. Why must you be so cruel, calling me here like this and refusing to see our daughter?
His lips were colorless, as if the blood had drained from them. His eyes were flat pools. Because you could give me a male heir, but refused to do so.
There is no truth in that, Majesty. Only rumors.
It required all her Bene Gesserit training to remain standing. I listen to intelligence reports, not rumors. The Emperor peered at her through one open eye, as if he could see her in more minute detail that way. Do you wish to die, Anirul?
It occurred to Anirul that he might kill her after all. There is certainly no love between us, but would he dare risk the sisterhood's ire by disposing of me?
At the time of his ascension to the throne, Shaddam had agreed to marry her because he needed the strength of a Bene Gesserit alliance in the uneasy political climate. Now, after a dozen years, Shaddam felt too confident in his position.
Everyone dies, she said.
But not the way I could arrange for you. Anirul tried not to show emotion and reminded herself that she was not alone. That within her psyche were the collective memories of the multitudes of Bene Gesserit who had come before her and remained in other memory. Her voice was utterly calm.
We are not the complex, devious witches we are made out to be.
This was not true, of course, though she knew Shaddam couldn't possibly have more than suspicions to the contrary. His demeanor didn't soften. What's more important to you, your sisters or me? She shook her head in dismay.
You have no right to ask me such a thing. I've never given you any reason to feel I've been less than faithful to the crown.
Lifting her head proudly,
Anirul reminded herself of her position in the long history of the sisterhood. She would never admit to him that she had orders from the Bene Gesserit hierarchy never to give birth to a Carino son. The wisdom of her sisters echoed through her mind. Love weakens. It is dangerous, for it clouds reason and diverts us from our duties. It is an aberration, a disgrace, an unforgivable infraction. We cannot love. Anirul tried to divert Shaddam's anger. Accept your daughter, sire, for she can be used to cement important political alliances. We should discuss her name. What do you think of Wensishya? With sudden alarm, she became aware of warm moisture on her inner thighs. Blood? Had the stitches broken? Red droplets were falling onto the carpet. Anirul saw him peering down at her feet. New rage consumed the emperor's features. That carpet has been in my family for centuries. Don't show weakness. He's an animal. We'll attack weakness and back down from strength. She turned slowly, allowing several more drops to fall, then staggered away. Given the history of House Carino, I am certain that blood has been spilled on it before. It is said that there is nothing firm, nothing balanced, nothing durable in all the universe, that nothing remains in its original state, that each day, each hour, each moment, there is change. Panoplia Propheticus of the Bene Gesserit. On the rugged shore beneath Castle Caladan, a lone figure stood at the end of a long dock, profiled against the sea and the newly risen sun. He had a narrow, olive-skinned face with a high-bridged nose, giving him the look of a hawk. Out on the water, a fleet of fishing coracles was just departing, trailing wakes behind them. Men in heavy sweaters, coats, and knit hats scrambled about on the cluttered decks, preparing their gear for the day. In the village downshore, wisps of smoke rose above the chimneys. Locals called it Old Town, the site of the original settlement, centuries before the elegant capital city and spaceport were built on the plain behind the castle. Duke Leto Atreides, dressed casually in blue fishing dungarees and a white tunic with a red hawk crest, took a deep breath of invigorating salt air. Though he was master of House Atreides, representing Caladan to the Landsrad and the Emperor, Leto liked to rise early with the fishermen, many of whom he knew on a first-name basis. Sometimes they invited the Duke to their homes, and, despite the objections of his security commander, Thufir Hawat, who trusted no one, he occasionally joined them for a fine meal of chopino. The salt wind picked up, whipping the sea into dancing white caps. He wished he could accompany the men, but his responsibilities were too great here. And there were matters of importance beyond his world as well. He owed allegiance to the Imperium as well as the people he ruled, and he found himself thrust into the middle of great things. The shocking murder of an Akazi diplomat by a Grumman ambassador was no small matter, even on distant Arrakis. But Viscount Mauritani didn't seem to care about public opinion. Already the great houses were calling for imperial intervention in order to avoid a larger conflict. The day before, Leto had sent his own message to the Landsrad Council on Kaitane, volunteering his services as a mediator. He was only 26 years old, but a veteran of a decade at the helm of a great house. He attributed his success to the fact that he had never lost touch with his roots. For that he could thank his late father, Paulus. Ostensibly, the old Duke had been an unpretentious man who mixed with his people, just as Duke Leto did now. But his father must have known, though he'd never admitted it to Leto, that this was also a good political tactic, one that endeared the Duke to his people. The requirements of the office made for a complex mixture. Sometimes Leto couldn't tell where his personal and official personas began and left off. Shortly after being thrust into his responsibilities, Leto Atreides had stunned the Landsrad with his dramatic trial by forfeiture, a bold gamble to escape being framed for an attack on two Tleilaxu ships inside a guild highliner. Leto's gambit had impressed many of the great houses, and he'd even received a congratulatory letter from Hundro Moritani, the puckish and unlikable Viscount of Grumman, who often refused to cooperate, or even participate, in matters of the Imperium. The Viscount said he admired Leto's brash flouting of the rules, proving that leadership is made by strong men with strong convictions, not clerks who study commas on law slates. Leto wasn't entirely sure that Moritani believed in his innocence. Instead, he thought the Viscount simply enjoyed seeing Duke Atreides get away unpunished, against such insurmountable odds. On the other side of the dispute, Leto had a connection to House Ekaz as well. The old Duke, his father, had been one of the great heroes in the Ekazi revolt, battling beside Dominic Vernius to overthrow violent secessionists and defend the Landsrad-sanctioned rulers of the forested world. Paulus Atreides himself had stood beside the grateful young Archduke Armand Ekaz during the victory ceremony that restored him to the Mahogany throne. Somewhere among the old Duke's possessions lay the chain of bravery that Armand Ekaz had placed around Paulus's thick neck. And the lawyers who had represented Leto during his Landsrad trial had come from the Ekazi region of Elaka. Since he was respected by both parties in the feud, Leto thought he might make them see a way to peace. Politics. His father had always taught him to be careful to consider the whole picture, from the tiniest to the largest elements. From his tunic pocket, Leto brought out a voice scriber and dictated a letter to his cousin, Shaddam IV, congratulating him on the joyous birth of another child. The message would be sent by official courier on the next Guild Highliner departing for Kaitain. When Leto could no longer hear the putt-putting of the fishing boats, he hiked up the steep zigzag path that led to the top of the cliff. He shared a breakfast in the courtyard with 20-year-old Duncan Idaho. The round-faced young man wore a green and black Atreides trooper uniform. His wiry dark hair had been cropped short, out of his eyes for vigorous weapons training. Thufir Hawat had spent a lot of time with him, proclaiming him to be a particularly skilled student. But Duncan had already reached the limits of what the warrior Mentat could teach him. As a boy, he had escaped from Harkonnen bondage to Castle Caladan, where he'd thrown himself upon the mercy of the old Duke. As he grew up, Duncan remained one of the most loyal members of the Atreides household, and certainly the best weapons trainee. Longtime military allies of House Atreides, the Swordmasters of Ginaz, had recently granted Duncan Idaho admission into their renowned academy. "I will be sorry to see you go, Duncan," Leto told him. 8 years is a long time." Duncan sat straight, showing no fear. "But when I return, my Duke, I will be better able to serve you in all ways. I'll still be young, and no one will dare threaten you." "Oh, they'll still threaten me, Duncan. Make no mistake about that." The young man paused before giving him a thin, hard smile. "Then they will be making the mistake, not me." He lifted a slice of Peridan melon to his mouth, took a bite of the yellow fruit, and wiped away the salty juice that ran down his chin. "I am going to miss these melons. Barracks food can't compare." He cut his portion into smaller sections. Bougainvillea vines trailed up the stone walls around them. But it was still winter, and the plants were flowerless. With unseasonable warmth and predictions of an early spring, though, buds had already begun to appear on trees. Leto gave a contented sigh. "I've seen no more beautiful place in all the vast reaches of the Imperium than Caladan in the spring." "Certainly, Gedi Prime can't compare." Duncan raised his guard. Uneasy to see how relaxed and content Leto appeared. "We must remain constantly on the alert, my Duke, not permitting the slightest weakness. Never forget the ancient feud between Atreides and Harkonnen." "Now you sound like Thufir." Leto scooped up a sweet mouthful of his pundi rice pudding. "I'm sure there is no finer man than you in the service of the Atreides, Duncan. But I fear we may be creating a monster in sending you away for 8 years of training. What will you be when you return?" Pride infused the young man's deeply set blue-green eyes. "I will be a swordmaster of the Ginaz." For a long moment, Leto thought of the extreme dangers at the school. Nearly a third of all students died during training. Duncan had laughed off the statistics, saying he had already survived far worse odds against the Harkonnens. And he was right. "I know you will succeed," Leto said. He felt a thickness in his throat, a deep sadness at letting Duncan go. "But you must never forget compassion. No matter what you learn, don't come back here with the attitude that you're better than other men." "I won't, my Duke." Leto reached under the table and brought out a long, thin parcel and passed it across the table. "This is why I ask you to join me for breakfast." Surprised, Duncan opened it and removed an ornately carved ceremonial sword. He gripped the inlaid rope pattern of the pommel.
"The old Duke's sword. You're lending it to me?"
"Giving it to you, my friend. Remember when I found you in the weapons hall just after my father died in the bull ring? You had taken this sword from the display rack. It was nearly as tall as you were then. But now you've grown into it." Duncan could find no words to thank him. Leto looked the young man up and down, appraising him. "I believe if my father had lived to see the man you've become, he might have given it to you himself. You're grown now, Duncan Idaho. Worthy of a Duke's sword."
"Good morning," a cheerful voice said.
Prince Romber Vernius sauntered into the courtyard, still bleary-eyed but dressed. The fire jewel ring on his right hand gleamed in stray sunlight. His sister Kylia walked beside him, her coppery hair held back by a golden clasp. Romber glanced from the sword to the tears brimming in Duncan's eyes.
"What's going on here?"
"Giving Duncan a going-away present." Romber whistled.
"Pretty fancy for a stable boy."
"Perhaps the gift is too much," Duncan said, looking at Duke Leto. He stared at the sword, then glared at Romber.
"I'll never work in the stables again, though, Prince Vernius. The next time you see me, I'll be a swordmaster."
"The sword is yours, Duncan," Leto said in his firmest tone, one he had copied from his father. "There will be no further discussion of the matter."
"As you wish, my Duke," Duncan bowed. "I beg to be excused, to prepare for my trip."
The young man strode across the courtyard. Romber and Kylia sat at the table, where their breakfast plates had been set up. Kylia smiled at Leto, but not in her customary warm fashion. For years, the pair had been tiptoeing around romantic involvement, with the Duke unwilling to get any closer because of political concerns, his need to wed the daughter of a powerful great house. His reasons were strictly those his father had drilled into him, a Duke's responsibility to the people of Caladan. Only once had Leto and Kylia held hands. He had never even kissed her. Lowering her voice, Kylia said,
"Your father's sword, Leto? Was that really necessary? It's so valuable."
"But only an object, Kylia. It means more to Duncan than to me. I don't need a sword to retain fond memories of my father." Then Leto noted the blonde stubble on his friend's face, which made Romber look more like a fisherman than a prince. "When was the last time you shaved?" "For a million hells, what difference does it make how I look?" He took a drink of Sidret juice, puckered his lips at the tartness. "It's not as if I have anything important to do." Kylia, eating quickly and quietly, studied her brother. She had penetrating green eyes. Her cat-like mouth was turned down in disapproval. As Leto looked across the table at Romber, he noted that his friend's face still retained a childlike roundness, but the brown eyes were no longer bright. Instead, they revealed deep sadness over the loss of his home, the murder of his mother, the disappearance of his father. Now only he and his sister remained of their once great family. "Makes no difference, I suppose," Leto said. "We have no affairs of state to conduct today, no trips to glorious Kytane. In fact, you may as well stop bathing altogether." Leto stirred his bowl of pundi rice pudding. Then his voice became uncharacteristically sharp. "Nonetheless, you remain a member of my court, and one of my most trusted advisors. By now, I'd hoped you might develop a plan to regain your lost holdings and position." As a constant reminder of the glory days of Ix, when House Vernius had ruled the machine world before the Tleilaxu takeover, Romber still wore the purple and copper helix on the collar of every shirt. Leto noted that the shirt Romber wore was badly wrinkled and needed to be washed. "Leto, if I had any idea what to do, I would jump on the next highliner and try." He looked flustered. "The Tleilaxu have sealed Ix behind impenetrable barricades. Do you want Thufir Hawat to send in more spies? The first three never found their way underground to the cavern city, and the last two vanished without a trace." He tapped his fingers together. "I just have to hope the loyal Ixians are fighting from within and will soon overthrow the invaders. I expect everything will turn out all right." "My friend the optimist," Leto said. Kylia scowled at her breakfast and finally spoke up.
"It's been a dozen years, Romber. How long does it take for everything to magically fix itself?"
Uncomfortable, her brother tried to change the subject. "Have you heard that Shaddam's wife just gave birth to their third daughter?" Kylia snorted. "Knowing Shaddam, I'll bet he's none too pleased that it wasn't a male heir." Leto refused to accept such negative thoughts.
"He's probably ecstatic, Kylia. Besides, his wife still has many child-bearing years left."
He turned to Romber. "Which makes me think, old friend, you should take a wife. To keep me clean and make sure I shave. To begin your house again, perhaps. To continue the Vernius bloodline with an heir in exile." Kylia almost said something, seemed to have second thoughts. She finished a melon, nibbled on a piece of toast. Presently she rose and excused herself from the table. During the long silence, tears glistened on the lower lids of the Ixian prince's eyes, then rolled down his cheeks. Embarrassed, he wiped them away.
Yes, I've been thinking about that myself. How did you know?
You've told me so more than once. After we've shared two or three bottles of wine. The whole thing is a crazy idea. My house is dead, and Ix is in the hands of fanatics. So, start a new house minor on Caladan. A new family trade. We could look over the list of industries and see what's needed. Kylea has plenty of business sense. I'll provide the resources you need to get established.
Romber allowed himself a bittersweet laugh. My fortunes will always remain closely allied with yours, Duke Leto Atreides. No, I'd better remain here to watch your backside, making sure you don't give the whole castle away.
Leto nodded without smiling, and they clasped hands in the half-handshake of the Imperium.
Nature commits no errors. Right and wrong are human categories. Parted Kinds, Arrakis Lectures. Monotonous days. The three-man Harkonnen patrol cruised over the golden swells of dunes along a 1,000-kilometer flight path. In the unrelenting desert landscape, even a puff of dust caused excitement. The troopers flew their armored ornithopter in a long circle, skirting mountains, then curving south over great pans and flatlands. Glossu Rabban, the Baron's nephew and temporary governor of Arrakis, had ordered them to fly regularly, to be seen, to show the squalid settlements that Harkonnens were watching, always. Keel, the side gunner, considered the assignment a license to hunt any freeman found wandering near legitimate spice harvesting operations. What made those dirty wanderers think they could trespass on Harkonnen lands without permission from the district office in Carthag? But few freemen were ever caught abroad in daylight, and the task had grown dull. Garan flew the thopter, rising up and dipping down to catch thermals, as if operating an amusement ride. He maintained a stoic expression, though occasionally a grin stole across his lips as the craft bucked and jostled in rough air. As they completed their fifth day on patrol, he continued to mark discrepancies on topographical maps, muttering in disgust each time he found another mistake. These were the worst charts he had ever used. In the back passenger compartment sat Jostin, recently transferred from Gedi Prime. Accustomed to industrial facilities, gray skies, and dirty buildings, Jostin gazed out over the sandy wastelands, studying hypnotic dune patterns. He spotted the knot of dust off to the south, deep in the open funeral plain.
"What's that? Spice harvesting operation?"
"Not a chance," the side gunner Keel said. "Harvesters shoot a plume like a cone into the air, straight and thin."
"Too low for a dust devil. Too small."
With a shrug, Garan jerked the thopter controls and soared toward the low reddish-brown cloud.
"Let's take a look."
After so many tedious days, they would have gone out of their way to investigate a large rock sticking out of the sand. When they reached the site, they found no tracks, no machinery, no sign of human presence. And yet acres of desert looked devastated. A mottled rust color stained the sands a darker ochre, as if blood from a wound had dried in the hot sun.
"Looks like somebody dropped a bomb here," Keel said.
"Could be the aftermath of a spice blow," Garan suggested. "I'll set down for a closer look." As the thopter settled on the churned sands, Keel popped open the hatch. The temperature-controlled atmosphere hissed out, replaced by a wave of heat. He coughed dust. Garan leaned over from the cockpit and sniffed hard.
"Smell it." The odor of burned cinnamon struck his nostrils. "Spice blow for sure." Jostin squeezed past Kiel and dropped onto the soft ground. Amazed, he bent down, picked up a handful of ochre sand, and touched it to his lips.
"Can we scoop up some fresh spice and take it back? Must be worth a fortune."
Kiel had been thinking the same thing, but now he turned to the newcomer with scorn.
"We don't have the processing equipment. You need to separate it from the sand, and you can't do that with your fingers."
Goran spoke in a quieter but firmer voice. "If you went back to Carthage and tried to sell raw product to a street vendor, you'd be hauled in front of Governor Rabban. Or worse yet, have to explain to Count Fenring how some of the Emperor's spice ended up in a patrolman's pockets."
As the troopers tromped out to the ragged pit at the center of the dissipating dust cloud, Jostin glanced around.
"Is it safe for us to be here? Don't the big worms go to spice?"
"Afraid, kid?" Kiel asked.
"Let's throw him to a worm if we see one," Goran suggested. "It'll give us time to get away."
Kiel saw movement in the sandy excavation, shapes squirming, buried things that tunneled and burrowed, like maggots in rotten meat.
Jostin opened his mouth to say something, then clamped it shut again.
A whip-like creature emerged from the sand, 2 meters long with fleshy, segmented skin. It was the size of a large snake, its mouth an open circle glittering with needle-sharp teeth that lined its throat.
"A sandworm," Jostin said.
"Only a runt," Kiel scoffed. "Newborn, do you think?" Goran asked.
The worm waved its eyeless head from side to side. Other slithering creatures, a nest of them, squirmed about as if they'd been spawned in the explosion.
"Where in the hells did they come from?" Kiel asked.
"Wasn't in my briefing," Goran said.
"Can we catch one?" Jostin asked.
Kiel stopped himself from making a rude rejoinder, realizing that the young recruit did have a good idea.
"Come on."
He charged forward into the churned sand. The worm sensed the movement and reared back, uncertain whether to attack or flee. Then it arced like a sea serpent and plunged into the sand, wriggling and burrowing. Jostin sprinted ahead and dove face first to grasp the segmented body 3/4 of the way to its end.
"It's so strong!"
Following him, the side gunner jumped down and grabbed the thrashing tail. The worm tried to tug away, but Goran reached the front, where he dug into the sand and grabbed behind its head with a stranglehold. All 3 troopers wrestled and pulled. The small worm thrashed like an eel on an electric plate. Other sandworms on the far side of the pit rose like a strange forest of periscopes sprouting from the sea of dunes, round mouths like black O's turned toward the men. For an icy moment, Kiel feared they might attack like a swarm of marrow leeches. But the immature worms darted away and disappeared underground. Goran and Kiel hauled their captive out of the sand and dragged it toward the ornithopter. As a Harkonnen patrol, they had all the equipment necessary to arrest criminals, including old-fashioned devices for trussing a captive like a herd animal.
"Jostin, go get the binding cords in our apprehension kit," the pilot said.
The new recruit came running back with the cords, fashioning a loop which he slipped over the worm's head and cinched tight. Goran released his hold on the rubbery skin and grabbed the rope, tugging while Jostin slipped a second cord lower on the body.
"What are we going to do with it?" Jostin asked.
Once, early in his assignment on Arrakis, Kiel had joined Rabban on an abortive worm hunt. They had taken a Freeman guide, well-armed troops, even a planetologist. Using the Freeman guide as bait, they had lured one of the enormous sandworms and killed it with explosives. But before Raban could take his trophy, the beast had dissolved, sloughing into amoeba creatures that fell to the sand, leaving nothing but a cartilaginous skeleton and loose crystal teeth. Raban had been furious. Kiel's stomach knotted. The Baron's nephew might consider it an insult that three simple patrolmen could capture a worm, when he'd been unable to do so himself. "We'd better drown it."
"Drown it?" Justin said. "What for? And why would I want to waste my water ration to do that?"
Garan stopped as if struck by a thunderbolt.
"I've heard the Freeman do it. If you drown a baby worm, they say it spits out some kind of poison. It's very rare."
Kiel nodded.
"Oh, yeah, the crazy desert people use it in their religious rituals. It sends everybody into frenzied wild orgies, and a lot of them die."
"But we've only got 2-liter jons of water in the compartment," Jostin said, still nervous.
"Then we only use one. I know where we can refill it anyway."
The pilot and his side gunner exchanged glances. They had patrolled together long enough that they'd both thought of the same thing. As if understanding its fate, the worm bucked and thrashed even more, but it was already growing weaker.
"Once we get the drug," Kiel said, "let's have some fun."
At night, with the patrol thopter running in stealth mode, they flew over the razor-edged mountains, approaching from behind a ridge and landing on a rough mesa above the squalid village of Belar Camp. The villagers lived in hollowed-out caves and above-ground structures that extended out to the flats. Windmills generated power. Supply bins glittered with tiny lights that attracted a few moths and the bats that fed on them. Unlike the reclusive freemen, these villagers were slightly more civilized, but also more downtrodden. Men who worked as desert guides and joined spice harvesting crews. They had forgotten how to survive on their world without becoming parasites upon the planetary governors. On an earlier patrol, Kiel and Garan had discovered a camouflaged cistern on the mesa, a treasure trove of water. Kiel didn't know where the villagers had gotten so much moisture. Most likely, they had committed fraud, inflating their census numbers so that Harkonnen generosity provided more than they deserved. The people of Belar Camp covered the cistern with rock, so that it looked like a natural protrusion. But the villagers placed no guards around their illegal stockpile. For some reason, desert culture forbade thievery even more than murder. They trusted the safety of their possessions from bandits or thieves of the night. Of course, the Harkonnen troopers had no intention of stealing the water. That is, no more than enough for their own needs. Dutifully, Jostin trotted along with their sloshing container, which held the thick, noxious substance exuded by the drowned worm after it had stopped thrashing and bucking inside the container. Awed and nervous about what they'd done, they'd dumped the flaccid carcass near the perimeter of the spice blow and then taken off with the drug. Kiel had been concerned that the toxic exhalation from the worm might eat its way through the leiterjohn. Garan operated the Belar cistern's cleverly concealed spigot and refilled one of their empty containers. No sense in letting all the water go to waste just for a practical joke on the villagers. Next, Kiel took the container of worm bile and upended it into the cistern. The villagers would certainly have a surprise next time they all drank from their illegal water hoard.